All right, welcome back to the e-commerce AI revenue revolution. Now, last time we were joined by Ari and Sammy here, and they talked a little bit more in depth about Sammy's experience at the Ross School of Business. Now, today is part two of that conversation, and this part of the conversation, we're going to get more into the weeds on Ari's experience. So I'm going to hand this over to you guys to touch on sort of Ari, your shift from academia to the tech industry. I know there are a lot of really interesting stories, especially as you touch on mergers and acquisitions. So I will let you guys take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Victoria. And Sammy, coming from the Sunshine State in Miami Beach.
Close, Marco Island, but...
Marco Island, even better. Okay.
Yeah.
Taking a break from your vacation to speak with us. Excellent. Okay, cool. Well, we had a really wonderful conversation last time about Ross School of Management, University of Michigan, the recruiting process and so forth. And one of the things that was really impactful to me was how much that had changed since my experience in 1991, I guess, graduating from Kalamazoo College, also in Michigan. But the Kalamazoo, which was a smaller school, and even the larger schools didn't have these more business-focused programs and those kinds of specializations. So we had to figure it out on our own. In a lot of ways. And that's a bit what I did. I went to graduate school and then talked my way into getting a deal over with IBM to help them build their website, and just rolled up my sleeves and started a company and didn't know what I was doing for a long time, and made a lot of mistakes the old fashioned way and somehow got out of it alive. So
wow.
different business model, I suppose. So along the way, one of the most complicated things that we ran into was raising capital. We had a bunch of experienced people that knew stuff. We didn't know anything about that. And then also doing acquisitions, another area where unless you have some experience, it's really easy to make some mistakes. So I'm curious to kind of get started. At Ross, are there specific M&A programs or venture capital programs, classes that focus on those? Because they're very narrow kind of specific things, you know?
Yes. So that's a great question. So at Ross, to my knowledge, no. So we don't have specific programs or classes, but we do have the clubs, which, you know, we got really into depth in the last episode. We talked a lot about what the clubs do. So from my experience, learning what you want to do is going to be through the clubs. Which, did you guys have that when you were an undergrad? What was that experience? I mean, how did you decide you wanted to do technology? Did you have the majors? Did you have, because I know each school runs so different.
Right. Majors, really just the majors. No external clubs or anything like that, which makes a lot of sense to have clubs because there are so many small details that are not necessarily relevant for all or even most businesses, but are hyper relevant for some. So, you know, from a business perspective, Kalamazoo College, at least where I went, really didn't have anything. We had an econ major and that was it. And then we had computer science, actually as a concentration, not even as a major at the time. So I was a math major with computer science and then went into graduate school to study computer science, which had no business classes. That was just hardcore CS. But the club model makes a ton of sense. So for example, when it comes to raising capital, a lot of entrepreneurs that have a small business, step one is to get your first customer and to be able to not starve to death. We did that in 1996. I started my first company, Fatwire. We got IBM as a customer, loaded up the van and moved to New York just because for some reason we thought it would be a good idea to be in their backyard. Never mattered, but we didn't know better. And in 2000, everyone was raising capital. Everyone was calling us up, had no idea what any of that meant. And then eventually took $10 million on an initial round of financing. Luckily, with terms that were actually pretty favorable for in hindsight, but we would have accepted anything or not accepted anything because we just didn't know. And it's like $10 million. That sounds like a lot of money. I don't know. So we got lucky though, because having run a company off of credit cards from 96 to 2000, and I think that we're probably in the $4 million revenue range at that point, we didn't know how to waste money. And everybody in the dot-com era was burning money like mad. So we get $10 million in 2000, and all of a sudden, you have the dot-com crash. And when you're addicted to spending money, it's difficult to stop. And businesses are going out of business left and right, bankruptcies all over the place. And we're sitting on $10 million bucks and we don't even know how to spend it. What are we going to do with this money? stare at it all day?
Good problem to have.
I bought my first cell phone. I was like, oh, all right, wait, we're going to get a cell phone, man. Okay. So in the process of all of this that was going on, you had tremendous bankruptcies and a company that had at one point a $4.2 billion market cap, which was a roll-up. It was actually a VC fund gone public, roll-up of all of its portfolio companies, had a $2 billion portfolio company, or at least that was the market cap of the company, that was part of the bankruptcy. And we bought that company for $7 million. One day, people were paying $2 billion for this company, and we came in and bought it for $7 million the next day. And it was the craziest thing. So this is 2000. People thought they were the geniuses of the world. Pets.com blows up. Everything blows up. And this business, which had a $4.2 billion company, goes into bankruptcy. Golden Gate Capital, I remember, was the stalking horse at the bankruptcy, offered, I think, $50 million for the whole thing. And the judge says, you know what? Let's try to be get as much as we can. We're going to break this business into seven components, and we're going to take bidders on the components. And as long as all of the bidders add up to more than seven or more than the $50 million plus $1 million per bidder as a restructuring fee, they can have the business. And so we all get together. No one knows each other. We bid slightly more than the $50 million. And the stalking horse comes in. Hey, I'll throw in another $1 million. And this goes back and forth all night. Seven different bidders. Every round, all of the bidders are pretending like they're broke. Oh, I don't have any more money. Can you increase your bid to get over the stalking horse? Oh, can you increase yours? And towards the end of the evening, everyone really is out of money. And Golden Gate starts only going up by $500,000 instead of $1 million on each round. So I lean over to one of the venture funds that was buying one part of this group and said, hey, we really are broke. I'm not kidding anymore. But why don't you buy my chunk? And there'll be one less bidder, and that'll reduce our requirement by $1 million. So right there in real time on a yellow sheet of paper, we write an agreement. All right, I'll give you $7 million tomorrow if you buy my thing for me, and I'll get you the seven, and did it right there in court and bought this. And the CEO of the holding company goes bananas as he's watching $4.2 billion in market cap go out the door for, I think, all in $60 million, and me picking up what, in a lot of ways, was probably the crown jewel for $7 million. So the next day, I go up to Boston where headquarters were, and this was a company that we'd picked up. We actually picked up two similar companies, Future Tense and Open Market. And I go to the front door of the building, and they had rented out, this is dot-com stupidity, a building that we were paying about $350,000 a month in interest, the whole building custom built for them, with generators on the roof in case power goes down, and fiber optic coming in from every direction. And I go in the front door, and the manager of engineering is there, and he says, "Ari, I can't let you in." I'm like, "I just bought this company. Can't let me in?" Said, no, because prior owner, I'll save his name for now, is he says that's bullshit what you pulled in court, and he's going to contest it, and he's going to take this thing back. So I go back to my hotel, which was across the street, and trying to work this out. And every night I'm watching as people are stealing shit left and right. I just see all of these cars coming out every evening from this building, and they're taking stuff. And I'm like, good news, because if I'm not out of that building by the end of the month, I can't get out of the lease. I got 1 month to get out of this lease, and I'll be on the hook for $350 a month in rent. I got to get the hell out of this thing. So take it all. Mm-hmm. And I end up cutting a deal with the ex-CEO. I say, "Hey, I bought two of these things. You can take one for $3 million. I'll keep the other one for $4 million, and we'll be and that'll be it." And he's like, "Oh, it sounds like a great idea." So we split up the two different businesses that I bought, and now I got to get the hell out of this building. And I go in, and it's got gyms, and it's got huge cafeteria. It had a espresso machine that was like $70,000. It had 1,000 of these Aerolon chairs that cost $1,000 a piece, 1,000 at $1,000 a piece. That's $1 million worth of chairs that were still in the boxes. And the development company that had it says, "If you aren't out of this building by the end of the month, every desk removed, all of the custom wiring that brought power to each of those desks stripped out of it, you're on the hook for the rest of the 10-year lease on this thing at $350 a month." So we have semis coming left and right, and we're liquidating everything, selling computers by the pound. By the pound for computers. Get it out! Get it out! We're just moving everything out of this thing. Get the hell out of there. And Ariba, which was another company that went bankrupt, had an office right up the road that they were trying to get rid of. It was like 17,000 square feet. We needed like 5,000 square feet. Got it for pennies, and then speak with the CEO that we just got into a fight and then sold half of the business for, and said, "Hey, you want to be roommates? I've got all this extra space." "Yeah, sure." So now we're sharing office. It's like one day fighting, the other day selling stuff, then being roommates, and spent the next 4 years with just one big office space, a bunch of desks, living together. And that was a very successful acquisition, actually. Company, I think that when we picked it up, it had like $20 million in revenue, ended up selling it to Oracle when it was about $45 million in revenue, I don't know, 6 years later. Very profitable from the beginning. Wow. Operations Spain was really good. Support center in Singapore, Japan, all throughout Europe and Germany and Scandinavia. Big support center in Amsterdam. Amazing operation. So went from a couple guys that don't know how to spend money to watching the world fall apart to doing an acquisition in a crazy way, buying basically a direct competitor, going through all sorts of shenanigans, and then selling everything over to Oracle pretty quickly. So that's how we went to school back in the day.
Wow. That's a learning experience. That's a learning experience. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Do you still talk to the other guy, your roommate?
No, we never really became that friendly, honestly. We're kind of different generations. I'm saving the name. A lot of people who are watching this probably figure out who it is. I shouldn't go into specifics. Great guy. I think that he behaved totally rationally. You know, it's like, all right, see what I can get out of this thing. Yeah, WTF.
Yeah. Wow.
So after that, I took a trip into real estate, sold that business over to Oracle. A bottle of tequila later, I owned 7 miles of oceanfront in Belize. And that's where I really got business experience, because I started developing. I built whole towns, bridges, restaurants, hotels, houses, roads, swimming pools, everything. And you learn a lot about business in real estate. It's a hard industry. In a decade of that, I'm like, oh, this is too hard. I got to get back into technology, like artificial, easy stuff like artificial intelligence, like building houses, yeah. Real work.
Wow.
Went back. And then that's where M&A, even though in that real estate world bought 6 or 7 companies, actually. But in real estate, you're always sort of buying companies and so forth. That's a little bit of a different type of more of an asset purchase. But that's where M&A really turned on for me in the last 5 or 6 years in the technology space, because that's where acquisitions are really a desperate need for a lot of companies. It's the only way to grow and to survive in this space today, I believe.
Wow. Do you want to elaborate on that more, with M&A being, you know, one of the biggest ways to like drive through the technology sector right now? And I guess with your past experience, maybe how that's reflected on how, what you believe now with it.
You know, there's a fundamental problem in software. It's an opportunity, but it is a challenge. And that is that the probably the best, certainly the most mature, and probably the best business model for software companies today is the SaaS, software as a service model. The reason why SaaS is such a great model is because you have recurring revenue. Like, a big problem in the real estate world is that you sell someone a house, that's it. You got nothing else to do with that person, right? They're going to live in the house for 20 years and then they're going to go die, right? You can't, nothing else to do. but the acquiring that customer in the first place, finding that person that wants to build a house, is very expensive. It's time consuming. And if you go a while without finding a customer, all of a sudden you could go out of business, even though you've got really great operations and so forth. And the SaaS model, because it's fundamentally a subscription business, you have recurring revenue. You sell somebody a month usage of a product, and then they buy it again for the next month and the next month and so forth. And then the SaaS model, so there's other subscription models, like I could subscribe to Wine of the Month Club. That's a subscription model, and that's good. You have recurring customer. It's better than just sell them a bottle of wine, and then next week when they want more wine, they end up going to a different store and buying from someone else. They're with you. But unlike Wine of the Month, software is the term that we often use is sticky. So it's sticky in that once you own or using somebody's software, you are often developing other tools and relying on it and making it more and more difficult to decouple yourself from that software. I buy a piece of marketing software, and then I integrate that with my finance software, and I integrate it with my customer relationship software. And then if I want to switch marketing software, I've got to tear those integrations apart and integrate again. So you get the recurring revenue component, and you also get the stickiness. So that's great. And that's why pretty much every software company in the last decade has moved towards SaaS. The challenge with SaaS is the what's often called the cash flow trough. And in the problem with the cash flow trough is that you're, if I'm going to sell you a 36-month SaaS subscription, each month is going to be fairly cheap. They might add up to a large number at the end of 36, but the individual months can't be terribly expensive. However, my marketing and sales expenses all happen before month one, right? I mean, I got to have an ad before I can talk to you, and then I've got to have a salesperson talk to you, and then I got to pay a commission to that salesperson. I'm going to get you to sign a contract, and then you're going to pay for your first month. And you often have, and that's called CAC, your customer acquisition cost. And then you often have a basic formula, which is your CAC paid back. Your CAC payback is your customer acquisition cost divided by your monthly recurring revenue. CAC payback turns into the number of months to recoup just the sales and marketing expenses. You're still not making profit. And that is a challenge in software, in that your CAC payback is often 18 months, for instance. So if you're a small startup company, you can have great software, but it costs you, it takes you 18 months just to break even on the first sale. And if you sell two or three licenses on day one, then you have to pay back two or three times the CAC. And you end up with what's called a trough, where the amount of money you have to pay back, the greater your sales, the stronger your sales, the more money you lose until that CAC payback day. And then you slingshot out of it, you're making a ton of money. So what happens, and how this comes back into M&A, is that the smaller businesses often cannot finance themselves past that CAC payback period. And because the model is so attractive and you've got recurring revenue and you're sticky and everybody wants to be in the software business, you have, and it's, there's a lot of good ideas out there, and things like artificial intelligence are allowing you to innovate. There's a huge number of good software companies, much more than the number of venture capitalists. And the even the great ideas cannot attract enough capital to get through that cash flow trough and get past the CAC payback. And this is where M&A comes in. If you look at a segment in the software industry, like marketing technology, the segment that I'm in MarTech, there's an analyst called Chief MarTech that has been running a report called the MarTech 5000, still calls it the MarTech 5000. But what it is back in like 2017, 2018, the number of MarTech companies hit 5,000, and he was tracking the growth, and it went from like 500 to 1,000 to 3,000 to 5,000, and it kept on going. And the amazing thing was, is that when it went, for example, from 3,000 companies to 5,000 companies, what had actually happened is that we were 3,000 companies, 1,500 died, and 3,500 were born, and that's how it goes from 3 to 5. And then it went from 5 to 7,000, with a huge number dying and a huge number being born. And a lot of the ones that died shouldn't have died. So consolidation comes into a segment like this because it's overpopulated, undercapitalized, full of great ideas, and people are dying for the wrong reason. And they have a better future if they're combined with other companies. Above and beyond that, when you combine multiple companies, you're combining smart people, products, and customer bases. And this CAC payback formula that I described, the number of months you have to pay for the advertising and sales up front, and then you start collecting revenue. When you combine customer bases, you cut your CAC, your customer acquisition cost, substantially, because the advertising and sales, how much advertising do you really need to sell a new product to an existing customer, right? You don't have to go to a conference and pay for a booth to meet that customer. Mm-hmm. You don't have to buy a Google AdWord. You don't have to put a Super Bowl ad out there. You just have to call them up. They're picking up the phone because you're already running half of their business for them. So when you combine two businesses, that have synergistic technologies, you're able to reduce your CAC further by taking the product from business one and selling it into business two's customer base, and the product from business two and selling it into business one customer base. So MarTech, overpopulated, great ideas, companies unable to get past the cash flow trough, undercapitalized. If you can combine these businesses, and consolidation is happening big time in MarTech, I'm getting calls, multiple calls per month from bankers looking to sell companies. And you can have the right synergies. You tackle the cash flow trough problem. You tackle the capitalization problem. It's a lot easier to raise money for a large business than it is for a small business, where you have a lot of risks. One blows the wrong way and the company dies. You get free talent because you have talent problems in the software industry. You get expanded customer bases and so forth. And the M&A in these spaces is becoming, in a certain sense, formulaic, because so many transactions have happened that the key characteristics of a deal are becoming well understood. And that expedites, it reduces risk, in deals and speeds the negotiation substantially. So when you take a look at a MarTech M&A deal, you will know that you've got often 2 to 3 times revenue as a valuation, 50% upfront, 50% 2 years later as a percentage of retained revenue, as an earnout, deferred revenue as a tripping point. Other aspects of the deals are also often very common as well. It's much simpler to do deals in these crowded spaces after a few years when everybody knows what to expect. So that's what that's kind of my journey and kind of where I am right now, is getting into a crowded space on purpose, because I've got some experience. I know how to capitalize businesses and I know how to run deals, and taking advantage of the challenges that are not fair, but life is not fair, that cause businesses to be better off being bought. And it's a better career for a lot of the individuals as well, rather than living in their van like I used to.
Business is business. I mean, wow. So you have a lot of experience with it. You see the potential. What advice would you give to, I guess, the younger generations who are looking to go into MarTech and, or, you know, other industries that have high populated spaces? What's advice that you would give to them from your experience going into it, experiencing it now?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the first thing that comes to mind is that risk creates growth, it creates value, and if you're not taking risks, you're probably not going to be as successful as if you are. I mean, you don't want to do dumb stuff, but especially if you're coming straight out of school and you don't have obligations like kids that you have to put through college or whatever, take risks. Consider entrepreneurship. Worst thing that happens, you learn a ton and go get the same job you would have gotten straight out of school anyways, or even a better one because you've got more experience to stand on. So take those risks. Second of all, this gets a little bit more specific, but there are going to be really interesting opportunities because of what has happened in the last 18 months with artificial intelligence. And these opportunities are going to blindside a lot of industries, and it's going to become extremely difficult for people who are more experienced in any industry to shake off the history and think fresh. And someone young coming out of school that doesn't have that kind of baggage and is going to just see these new AI tools as just another tool, not as a threat or is just something weird that they don't understand or whatever, are going to leverage them that way and solve problems that others take for granted as being systemic problems that'll be there forever. Solve them like that and then focus on new value creation. And I think it's going to be extremely exciting. And it's going to really require a new generation of thinkers. It's going to be difficult for anyone to just throw away the past and to start over. You have to be coming at it fresh. So if I was graduating today, straight out of undergrad, first of all, I'm not so sure I would go to graduate school. I think that there's like too much exciting stuff happening. I don't know that I'd want to wait a couple more years. And I did 5 years of PhD. Probably wouldn't do it. I don't know. You know, you got a different perspective at different points in life. I don't want to poo-poo on graduate school at all. I love education, but things are moving quick, and a bunch of books are perhaps not going to keep up with that. So move quickly into that. I would take a hard look at what's going on with very boring industries that people are taking for granted. I don't know what a good industry would be. Building streets and anything else I could just get a feel for and just say, oh, how could I just turn that upside down and use some of these technologies? It's like, oh, okay, great. Well, these guys that build streets don't realize that in the agricultural industry. They're driving these tractors with robots for the last, you know, since 2005, and you still have humans driving these pavers around doing streets. So I'll just do that. And I'm going to put all the street guys out of business. I'm going to be the queen of street building and billionaire. I don't know. I'm just making it up as I go off in my head. But Sammy, go build some streets and see what happens.
Wow. That's great advice. That's great advice. Especially, I mean, I've, what, 3 more years of undergrad. So we'll see what happens. We'll
yeah,
see.
You're going to miss it all, man. You're too old.
Wow. Yeah, you definitely.
Oh. I got one more thing, though, which is that I think that you mentioned clubs, for instance. Social relationships are going to become, I think, increasingly important as more and more things are automated with AI. One of the things that I guess by definition can't be automated is interpersonal relationships. And people can argue about like, but I could have a relationship with a robot, or my robot could have a relationship with another robot. Sure. But also humans can have relationships with other humans, and it creates dynamics and opportunities that are, I think, you know, just unique in that regard. And being in those clubs and those social circumstances and having those interpersonal experiences are going to create opportunities. And if you think of some of the most interesting things that have really happened in technology, at least with like social media, you know, a lot of those are really about interpersonal relationships. And now with whatever Meta's doing with goggles and so on, new things are going to come out of there. I can't even imagine where it's all going. But those clubs really do sound very interesting from a business perspective. And I think they've always been that way. I think that maybe it was a little bit different, but if you were in a club over at Harvard getting an MBA back in 1970, those relationships took you to the street and you were doing, you know, selling junk bonds to your buddy over in, you know, JP Morgan Chase or something like that. Now it'd be, you know, maybe a little bit of a different result, but I think that those are valuable.
Well, I just wanted to pop in here. I know we're right about time, but I would say this has been one of the most entertaining episodes that we've had so far. Loved hearing about your experience in the earlier stages of your career, and I think that rounds out, you know, the conversation of going from academia to
work. Sammy, she's giving us the hook, pulling us off stage.
Sorry, guys. but I do want to thank you. Was there any last questions that you wanted to cover before we say goodbye?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we got great advice from you, Ari. You really covered that your education perspective, and I think your advice for this younger generation coming out of school is going to be very helpful and very helpful. Thank
cool.
you.
All right.
Well, love that you guys touched on AI as well. There's definitely some really good advice there for future workforce folks. All right, guys. Well, with that, we'll hopefully.
I'm going skiing. Sammy's going back to the beach, right?
Perfect. All right. You guys have a good rest of your day. We'll see you later. Bye, all.
Bye.